Okay, welcome back for the second lecture in this series on Monte Carlo methods in dynamical triangulations. So yesterday we looked at the two-dimensional random geometries. Today we're going to get our hands a bit more dirty and discuss higher dimensions. So what I want to convey to you is that many things are definitely harder in higher dimensions. Geometry is harder in higher dimensions. Actually, saying something about quantum gravity is certainly harder in higher dimensions. But one thing which is not substantially harder in higher dimensions is doing Monte Carlo simulations of random geometry. So I hope that yesterday I've given you all the necessary ingredients for you to go home and do Monte Carlo simulations of two-dimensional random geometries using these flip moves. And I hope at the end of this lecture that you could do the same and do Monte Carlo simulation of higher dimensional geometries. So this will be the outline for today. So yesterday I did not mention quantum gravity at all, except the fact that I would not mention it. Now I think I can't get away with not mentioning quantum gravity, so I will. Then we'll go into triangulations in higher dimensions, how they represent geometry. And we'll discuss a combinatorial representation, the generalization of the one that we discussed yesterday, which is the one that the computer is going to use to represent this geometry. I'm going to generalize the Monte Carlo methods that we discussed yesterday. And then we'll actually see that these geometries in higher dimensions actually have quite different features than the ones we saw yesterday. In particular, the two-dimensional geometries we saw yesterday, they were automatically critical. They had features at every scale. And this will be different in higher dimensions, which is perhaps a good thing, because we know that gravity is not critical by itself. It does not have features at every scale. We don't see space-time fluctuating here in the classroom. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. And then, depending on how much time I'll have, I'll show that all the techniques we've discussed can immediately be applied to a more specific setting, which is causal dynamical triangulations, which is a model which that in the last 10 years or so has acquired the most attention among the random triangulations and Monte Carlo simulations. OK? So, quantum gravity. When we think of quantum gravity, we quite often think about a space-time path integral. We've seen the space-time path integral yesterday in Benjamin's talk. So what is a space-time path integral formally? Formally, it's an integral. It's a Feynman-like path integral over all possible histories of a space-time. So in a history of a space-time is typically encoded as a Lorentzian metric on some manifold, so it defines some light cones. And any such metric, it determines a possible history of our space-time. And then Feynman told us that we have to integrate over all of these. We have to weight them by some phase given by some action. And then maybe something comes out, tells us something about what the quantum system looks like. But there are a number of difficulties when I write down this formal object. First of all, the standard techniques to look at such path integrals are perturbative. So which means that we try to do this integration by taking our metric g alpha beta to be a small perturbation of the trivial metric, flat Minkowski metric. But then one runs into problems with the non-renormalizability of gravity. So if one wants to go away from the perturbative regime, one wants to do something non-perturbative, one really has to integrate over metrics which are not just small perturbations. And we really have to understand what it is we're writing here. So what are these ingredients? So we have now an integral, which is some functional, infinite dimensional integral over some space of all Lorentzian geometries. OK, that's already a bit of a tough mathematical object. We have to decide on what this integration measure is. And we have to make sure that the integration measure is invariant under diffeomorphisms. We don't want to take two different metrics, which are actually the same geometry, to be counted independently. And then we want to do this integral, and we hope that when you take into account all these phases, that they destructively interfere for all the wild geometries, and that the only thing that is left is something which is classical or fluctuations around it. Now, one can imagine that this is a very delicate thing. I mean, if you have many complex numbers which all have absolute value 1, then... Okay, so destructive interference is delicate. Then, okay, what does this number actually mean? It's a phase. Okay, but what is a phase of a geometry? It's and needless to say, if you actually just want to evaluate this, if I put this into Mathematica, Mathematica won't actually evaluate my integral. So what we can try to do is try to sequentially simplify this formal object into a form where we can say something sensible about it, or even manipulate it into a form where we can compute it. And then we have to argue that we can actually work our way back up again to the more complicated path integrals we're interested in. And the first thing one can do, or which one would wish to do, and it solves some of the problems, and it introduces also other problems, is a weak rotation. So instead of integrating over all Lorentzian metrics, you want to integrate over all Riemannian metrics, and replace the complex phase by a real Boltzmann weight. Now, this seems like an odd ad hoc thing to do, but we've seen already in Giefer's talk that in many occasions, the quantum mechanical description of a d-dimensional system can be equivalent to the statistical description of a d plus one dimensional system. So this is kind of the analog of such a feature. Okay, so we have changed the path integral to something like this. So what problems does it solve? Well, I mean, the destructive interference we were looking for here, is not present here anymore, this problem, because some of the geometries will get a large action and they will be suppressed by this factor, and some of them will get a small action and they're enhanced. But there is nothing that has to destructively interfere anymore. Also, we can actually interpret what this integrand now means. Since this is like a Boltzmann factor, we can think of this as a probability distribution on all metrics, formally. Now, we also are introducing new problems by doing this. For instance, no matter what action I take here, if this is the Einstein-Hilbert action or some other local action of metrics, they will actually not have a minimum at the classical solutions. Typically, they will even be unbounded for below. So there will be always be wild metrics which have a very negative action, and they will be very much enhanced. Okay? And okay, it's not any easier to numerically evaluate this formal integral. So we go one step further. So we want to somehow get rid of the uncountably infinite number of degrees of freedom here, and just be left with something that I can manage. And one way to do this is to replace the set of metrics by something which is piecewise linear. So one can imagine that the space of all piecewise linear geometries is more easily described. So there is a countably infinite number of parameters that describe the lengths of the edges. And perhaps there is some sum over the combinatorial ways that I can define these triangulations. So it kind of simplifies the integral I had here to something which is perhaps a regular integral. But it also introduces new problems. Well, since this is now actually an integral that I could, in principle, feed to Mathematica, it could be that this integral just diverges. The answer is infinity. And then we still have not learned that much. And also the fact that we've introduced a cutoff means that, okay, we don't really want gravity to be described by triangles. I mean, I don't expect that to happen. So we have to argue that we can do something to our system to remove the cutoff again. So that's a new problem we're introducing by doing this. Okay, but we want to make it even slightly simpler. So we do another step, which you might call the discretization step, where we want to get rid of all the integrals and just have a sum. So we want to represent geometries by combinatorics. And this is the dynamical triangulation approach, where we fix the geometry of all the triangles, and we only let the combinatorics, the gluing, be dynamical. And now one can think, okay, but of course you can choose to just throw away almost all the geometries that appear here and then get something and then you compute it, but okay. How might this be related to the original object? One thing one should keep in mind is that if you take sufficient number of such triangles or other building blocks, you can approximate any metric that appeared in this path integral above. You may need many, 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 but you know that if you take, say, the limit of an infinite number of triangles, they will define points in my formal space of all metrics, and this will, in a certain mathematical sense, be dense in this space. So by going to this combinatorial representation, I'm telling you, I'm giving you a scattering of points in this space of geometries. And by taking a number of triangles to go to infinity, it becomes denser and denser, and it defines for you a measure in this space. So the combinatorial representation defines a measure even in the continuous space of geometries. Okay, but so we've done this discretization. What problems does it solve? Well, so first, the numerical evaluation was doable in principle. I'm saying that if you do discretization, it's actually doable, and we'll see how to do it. The action being unbounded from below is even true here, but here in the combinatorial setting, there are only a finite number of geometries at fixed size, so there will always be a minimal action, so it can be unbounded. I mean, if you have a finite number of numbers, there is always a bound given by the smallest and the largest. Okay, so we saw that the integrand is still a probability distribution. Now, there are still these questions remaining here. Does the integral converge? Or here, does the sum converge? And the answer might be yes or no. And typically, actually, it diverges. Or we can do one further restriction, restrict the topology of the surfaces or the geometries we're interested in, and then typically it converges. So we get a finite number.
We get divergence is observed even when number of triangles are fixed.
Okay, if the number of triangles fixed, of course it kind of diverges because there's, yeah. But if you would take a grand canonical ensemble and a local action, then it would always diverge if you let the topology be anything.
That's it. I thought if you fix the number of triangles, you cannot really make it pretty complicated.
Okay, I mean, if you fix a number of triangles, then this is a non-issue, of course. Yes.
So we need the continuum limit.
Okay, so I mean, I've crossed out some of the problems by going to the simpler setting.
Is boundedness sufficient, or do you need the action to be positive, actually?
Boundedness is sufficient.
For negative values, some geometries get exponentially enhanced in weight.
I mean, the overall constant does not come into the partition function. So there will always be a minimal action, and we could normalize that to be zero.
Way to identify regularization independent quantity of regularization independent question or its default, or do you just work on this specific thing?
So the discretization dependent?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is something one has to address afterwards, yes. And that's not something we can do at this formal level. I mean,
it quantum field theory, for example, you know, we more or less understand what is regularization dependent question, what is meaningful.
Yeah, but okay, but in quantum field theory, at least some of these objects have some mathematical meaning. For me, these objects still have no mathematical meaning until I know some way how to compute them, and then we can start discussing these questions.
The reason I asked this, you know, eventually this Euclidean version turns out to be problematic, I think, but I wonder if it's a problem of that formal level already a problem, or regularization can be a problem.
But I mean, there are all kinds of opportunities for problems here. We're looking for places where there are no problems. Okay, so this is the reason why we're interested in random combinatorial geometries as some kind of regularization of the continuum path integral. So what would be the best scenario in this setting? So we have this statistical system of random geometries, and suppose we have some phase diagrams or a number of couplings. And we choose some set of couplings, and we choose some system size. Then my black box would spit out a random geometry built from some triangles, say 100. And then I could say, OK, well, spit out something which is bigger, say 10,000 triangles. So I would get a bigger geometry. And a million triangles, I would get an even bigger geometry. Now, suppose that this phase has the feature that it is not automatically critical, like in the two-dimensional case. But there is some finite correlation length, psi. And when you go above this correlation length, the fluctuations start to diminish. There will be some emergent background geometry with fluctuations around it. I mean, it's a possible scenario. So for instance, here, suppose this blue dashed curve, it represents the constant curvature sphere. And perhaps my random geometry will fluctuate around this constant curvature sphere. And the fluctuations will be of order of the correlation length. OK, so suppose I sample some random geometry at a different set of couplings. Then, in general, the correlation length will be a different length as compared to the size of the triangle. But it's possible that if you compare your geometry at scales larger than the correlation length to the correlation length, that it actually looks pretty similar to what it had for a different set of couplings. So suppose one can find two such points where, indeed, above the correlation length it looks similar. Then clearly we have to increase the number of triangles when we do this, because below the correlation length there are many more triangles. Now suppose we can continue this, we find another set of couplings where, again, there are more triangles below the correlation length. Then we're zooming into some geometry which is really wildly fluctuating, while outside the correlation length it's little fluctuating. So from the quantum gravity point of view, we would think of this correlation length as defining some kind of Planck scale. I mean, when we think about the space-time geometry, we expect space-time geometry to fluctuate little above the Planck scale and wildly below the Planck scale. OK, so how can we make sure that correlation lengths become larger and larger compared to the lattice spacing? Well, we've seen already in the, say, the Ising model, that to do this, we need a phase transition. And we need a continuous phase transition. Because at a continuous phase transition, correlation lengths, they start to diverge. And that's what we need here. So suppose we can find some path in a phase diagram that ends at some continuous phase transition. Then these triangles compared to the correlation length would become smaller and smaller. Or you could say the correlation length becomes larger and larger and larger, but this is just how you choose your units. Then perhaps at this phase transition, or OK, if you scale towards this phase transition, you wouldn't even be able to see your triangles anymore. You would have a continuum geometry, which is semi-classical far away from the correlation length. And below the correlation length, you would have some fractal weird geometry. And this is a scenario that would be really pleasant to have. I mean, It's a random, continuous geometry. It has semi-classical behavior, so there is some kind of classical limit. And I've removed the cutoff, in some sense. I've removed the discretization. Okay, I mean, this is, yeah.
So if you look at the picture of the easy model of criticality, where the correlation length is very comparable with the system size, you can still appreciate fluctuations. It's just that all these fluctuations are correlated with each other because the correlation length is very large. What you're saying here is that you don't see fluctuations.
Well, you see fluctuations when you're below or at the order of the correlation length, like in the Ising model. But if you're going to look at scales which are much larger than the correlation length, then you won't see fluctuations even in the Ising model. So you're not exactly at criticality, but you're scaling towards criticality. If you're in the Ising model and you scale the size of your lattice, so you take n to be larger, and you also tune your temperature at the same time towards the critical value, then you get this double scaling limit where you might get a...
You do them at the same time.
Yes, so this is important. You have to do this at the same time.
Okay. So it's the two parameters depend on each other so that you get this behavior.
Yes.
Okay.
That would be the division.
Right. Okay.
I mean, that's what one might hope to find out.
Yeah.
But these are very non-trivial features to have a phase diagram where you get semi-classical behavior. Okay, but let's keep that in mind. Okay, back to basics. That was quantum gravity. Now we're going to actually look for some of these features in our simulations. Okay, piecewise linear geometry. That's going to be the geometries we're going to look at, and we're going to look at piecewise linear geometries built from simplices. So let me remind you what a simplex is. So for a simplex in d dimensions, we take d plus 1 vectors in d-dimensional space, or d plus 1 points. So in 3 dimensions, we take 3 points, 1, 2, 3. And a simplex is just the convex hull of these points, I guess. And you can write it mathematically like this. So in 3 dimensions, you would take 4 points, and you take all the points that sit in the middle of these 4 points. And we view these as subsets of Euclidean d-dimensional space, so they have a Euclidean metric associated to them. And we can use these as the building blocks to build up geometry. So we can take two simplices and glue them along one of their d-1 dimensional simplices. A triangle, I can glue them along an edge if they both have the same length. And we already saw yesterday that indeed it's still flat at the edge. If you have two tetrahedra of the same shape triangle, we can glue them together. If we have four simplices, we can glue them along a tetrahedron. And if one does this, and one produces a topological manifold out of this, one can ask, well, where is the non-trivial geometry here? Where is the curvature? And we heard in Benjamin's talk yesterday that the curvature actually sits on the d-2 dimensional simplices. In my language. So in the two-dimensional triangulations, if I glue cyclically a number of triangles, and I glue this one there, then I can add up all the angles. And if the angles do not add up to 2 pi, then it will actually be curved. And it's the same in 3 dimensions. If I take a couple of tetrahedra and I compute the total all the dihedral angles of these tetrahedra around an edge, and it's not equal to 2 pi, then there is curvature on this edge. And this curvature is kind of singular. It's not a smooth curvature. But there is a natural way to integrate, say, the scalar curvature over space-time, if you like. And the result is the Regé action. And the Regé action, so this is just the scalar curvature integrated over your geometry, is given by taking these angles, the total angle, comparing it to 2 pi, so that gives me the deficit angle at that point, or at that edge, or in the triangle in the four-dimensional case. Multiply it by the size of the d minus two dimensional simplex. So here that would be the length of the edge. And then just sum over all the edges. Now, in our setting, we're going to do geometries in which all the building blocks have the same shape. In particular, we're going to take all of them to be equilateral for simplicity. So if all tetrahedra are equilateral here, that means that this size of the edges will all be equal to 1, say. And then this action is just a sum over angles. And one can work out explicitly what the result of this is if you have a particular number of tetrahedra, a particular number of constituents. But since this is a linear object, it's clear what the answer should be. Since all of these angles come inside of these tetrahedra, the result can only be something which is strictly linear in the number of tetrahedra and the number of edges. So if I take the Einstein-Hilbert action, so this object, perhaps add a cosmological constant term if you like, then no matter what the exact geometry of my equal building blocks are, you'll get something which is linear in the number of building blocks and, say, linear in the number of d minus 2 simplices. And if you like, you could try to express these linear coefficients in terms of Newton's constant, cosmological constant, but we won't do that. Now, the fact that the Einstein-Hilbert action can be expressed in this way, it hints towards the fact that, okay, maybe it's a good idea to include such action in our simulations. Now, I'm going to argue that even if I did not know about the Einstein-Hilbert action at all, I would still have included these two terms in my action. So one could also forget about this slide, if you like. Okay, so we're going to put these geometries in the computer. So we need a combinatorial representation like we had yesterday. And to set the stage, remember yesterday that we could build a two-dimensional geometry out of polygons by giving a gluing prescription. So here is a particular two-dimensional triangulation of the sphere. And these orange lines, they tell me what to glue. And I think you can see what the triangulation of the sphere looks like. If I actually plot it in three dimensions, it's the tetrahedron. And the tetrahedron is exactly going to be the building block of our three-dimensional triangulations. So let's use this two-dimensional triangulation as a starting point to describe our three-dimensional triangulation. And to this end, I'm going to ask my mouse assistant to return to the stage. So we've seen that we can explore a map or a gluing prescription on polygons by telling my mouse how to navigate. And since we're going to now go into the third dimension, I've equipped my mouse with little sticky feet. So it can also walk on walls and on ceilings, as you will see. So we saw that we can navigate a map using the next and adjacent permutation. So next, it just goes to the next wall. So in the three-dimensional picture, it goes there. And then it can go adjacent, which in the three-dimensional picture is going on, walking on the wall. We can go next again, adjacent. See, look, it has sticky feet, you can see. So in the three-dimensional picture, one should really think of my mouse as walking on the inside of the tetrahedra. So keep that in mind. OK, so now another next. OK, so now I want to build three-dimensional geometries out of my tetrahedra. So what shall I do? I mean, clearly, if my mouse is only allowed to go next and adjacent, it will stay in this tetrahedron. So does anyone have any suggestions on what kind of operation to add to this list?
Some kind of rodent tunneling.
A tunneling? Maybe that's what's necessary here, yes.
Flip.
So you mean something like, oh, OK, no. OK, so what we need to go to three dimensions is an additional permutation, an additional instruction for my mouse. In fact, we're going to replace the adjacent permutation with a d minus 1 adjacent permutations, where we interpret a d as taking my mouse to its neighboring site, its neighboring d-dimensional site. So A2, in the case of two-dimensional triangulations, took my mouse from the two-dimensional triangle to the neighboring two-dimensional triangle. Now in three dimensions, I also have A3, which takes it to the neighboring three-dimensional simplex. So let's see. Okay, we have still have next, which does that. And we have adjacent 2, so that's going to neighboring two-dimensional simplex. And then we just take A3, which takes it from this edge to the neighboring simplex. I mean, is it clear that if you have this operation, then well, you can walk around in a T-tree reader and then go to the next? Yes?
They're just identified along one edge?
Oh, no. So this is meant to be glued along the whole triangle. Yes. That's what these dashed lines mean.
So that A2 is a distinct operation from A3, then. How would you distinguish between this side and the other one if they were all glued?
Well, so here you see his feet, and here you see his ears. That's how I know. it's the same. Okay, it's a generalization of the two-dimensional picture. So there, you could stay on both sides of this edge.
It has to do with the orientation, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, so still my mouse, he wants to walk on some floor and keep a wall to its right. And I said the mouse is going to walk on the inside. I mean, think of these teacher heater as rooms in your house. And then it can go to the other side of the wall. Or okay, so yesterday we saw that faces and edges and vertices corresponded to cycles of these permutations. So how would I identify tetrahedra using these three permutations? Or the rooms in this three-dimensional house.
Can you just use next and the first adjacent in order to stay in this dimension? You have to use the other adjacent?
Yes. Yeah. So if you're somewhere in some simplex, then you can apply next and adjacent too many times, and then you'll explore the whole room that the mouse was in. So what does this mean in the level of permutations? It means that we can look at orbits, not just of a single permutation, but of a pair of permutations. So the orbit under N and A2 is every position in this simplex that the mouse can go to. So the polyhedra are the orbits under this permutation. I mean, orbits are, again, partitions of all possible labels into. So labels, they are numbers on the positions where the mouse can be. Then orbits, they are a partitioning of all these possible mouse positions into its different rooms, its different tetrahedra. And similarly, the other constituents also correspond to orbits of different pairs of these permutations. So for instance, faces, if I just go next, 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 or A3, and then next, 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 it corresponds to this triangle, walking on both sides. Similarly, edges correspond to orbits under A2 and A3, and vertices correspond to this. And similarly, as in the two-dimensional case, as soon as you have these orbits, you can determine whether they're adjacent or not by studying whether one of the other permutations maps one of its numbers to a number of the other one. Okay, I see puzzled faces. So let's do edges. Let me define an edge as all the mouse configurations where the mouse is next to that edge. So where can the mouse be? Well, so suppose we're going to do this edge. And we're going to see this edge not as part of the simplex, but as part of the three-dimensional geometry. So since I'm gluing these tetrahedra, I mean, this edge and that edge are the same edge. Right? And there will be more tetrahedra going around here. So, okay, you can certainly go to A2, that's still the same edge. You can go to A3, and then you can go to A2 again, which is here, and then A3, A2, right? Okay, so in two dimensions we saw that in principle you can explicitly characterize what permutations on a certain integers actually give rise to a triangulation of the sphere or some other map on the sphere. So let's see what we can say in three dimensions. So now we have a triple of permutations, and when does this encode a three-dimensional geometry? So there are several of properties one has to check. So first of all these adjacent permutations have to be fixed 0.3 involutions, which is the mathematical term of this line, which is just saying that if you go adjacent and adjacent again, you have to be back. Then we have to make sure that these tetrahedra are properly glued to each other, which I can capture in the second condition, which is saying that going from this triangle to the triangle in the neighboring tetrahedron, which is A3, it should not matter whether I directly do that or first take a next to go to some other side of this triangle, then do an A3, and then do another next. So that's one condition that has to be satisfied too. If these two conditions are satisfied, then we know that the... okay, and let's do the third one too before I say this. Now a clear condition we also need is that these building blocks we're using are actually ball-like objects. I mean, tetrahedron, clearly, if you identify it as a subset of three-dimensional space, it has a topology of a ball. But in general, I mean, if you take any such permutation, it could have a torus topology or something weird. So we want to ensure that our building blocks are spheres, or three balls. And yesterday we saw that there is a simple criterion to write down, is using Euler's formula, which is a simple relation between the number of cycles within the map representation. Now, if the first three conditions are satisfied, then I have well-defined three-dimensional topological building blocks, and I can stack them together, and I'll get a three-dimensional geometry. And then the only thing one still has to check is that at each vertex, it's still locally three-dimensional space. And the thing that can go wrong is if you would look, say, at the direct neighborhood, say, at distance 0,1 from this vertex, that defines a two-dimensional surface. And this surface might actually have a topology which is not a sphere. It could be a torus, again. So one has to check that the orbits under NA2, NA3, which are the orbits defining the tetrahedra, also have a spherical topology, and that's also given by Euler's formula. It's easy to check. Okay, so far so good. This is a direct generalization of what I did in two-dimensional case. But in the two-dimensional case, I had a simple way of deciding what the topology of the resulting object was using Euler formula. So does this work in three dimensions as well? Well, we know that three-dimensional topology is really hard. And the answer is no. There is no way, no known algorithmic efficient way to decide what the topology will be of an arbitrary permutation satisfying these conditions. And this is important because this is one of the main reasons why there are basically no analytic results available yet on the combinatorics of three-dimensional geometry or higher dimensional. Luckily for us, we're going to do Monte Carlo simulations. And there is one important mathematical result which is actually the basis of all the currently known algorithms to decide a topology. And this result is that if you take any two triangulations of the same topology, there will always be a finite number of local moves one can do on one of them to get to the other. And this is also the most efficiently known algorithm to decide what the topology of a three-dimensional triangulation is. But that is exactly what we're doing in our simulations. So in fact, this is the only thing we need, because we are going to start with a triangulation of the correct topology, and then we're going to apply these local moves.
Does that mean that you can't change the topology?
It's not so easy to change the topology with local moves.
I mean, typically topology, you can do it only by cutting some kind of surgery or something of that sort, and reattaching things. But I guess in these moves, there's no way to do something like that.
No, I mean, probably one can cook up some moves, but whether they would work properly or not, I don't know. But okay, I said in the first slide that I'm going to restrict the topology. And one reason why is that if I would not do it, we get divergence. And in fact, if we do not restrict the topology, we can do analytic calculations, because it was exactly restricting topology which was the hard thing analytically. Okay. And the situation is very similar, even slightly worse in four dimensions, because there is no way to determine whether it's actually a manifold or not, because now around vertices we have three-dimensional geometries and we have no way of deciding whether those are actually spheres, which is needed to get actually a topological manifold. But this very same property which we use in the Monte Carlo simulation still holds in four dimensions, or actually in any dimension. Okay?
Just one more question, which is that your assessment of whether it's manifold-like depends on whether the local geometry looks like a sphere. Is that right?
Yes, that's a mathematical definition of topology. Yeah, so I mean, something is a...
That's a different definition than that.
No, I mean, a topological manifold is something where the neighborhood of each point is homeomorphic to an open bowl.
In this sense of that's exactly what you resort to in this decomposition as well, right?
Yes, okay, I mean, viewing these as topological spaces, so they have... Okay, I put in some Euclidean space here, which has a topology, and I glue it. It still has a topology. So it defines a unique topology, and for it to be the free sphere, you need to be.
It's still a continuous space.
Yeah.
All these things make sense.
Yes, but when it's not, I mean, so in this triangulation, when you're not, when you don't have a continuous space, like you're talking first linear.
Yeah, so here we're definitely restricting to nice piecewise linear manifolds which have well-defined topology.
Right, okay.
Okay, so what I said in the previous slides, it actually holds for any kind of geometry you can build out of polytopes. It need not necessarily be simplices. So let me define a triangulation in D dimensions to be one in which all the polytopes are simplices. Okay, you might have guessed that. So this is a three triangulation, so it's built out of tetrahedra. Now, if all these D-dimensional building blocks are the same, that means that my next and adjacent two permutations, they will always do the same thing. They'll just move you around this tetrahedron. So all the non-trivial information is contained in the adjacent three permutation, which tells me how the tetrahedra are glued to each other. So how many data do we have to keep track of? Well, if you work it out, then you see for a d-triangulation, every simplex has a d plus 1 factorial over 2 mouse positions. And every mouse position has a A2 number associated to it. So we have to keep track of this number of dynamical numbers that we have to update if we want to change the triangulation. And this grows a bit fast with dimensions. For 3, it's still 12, it's still quite nice. But for a 4 simplex, this is already 60 numbers, which gets a bit out of hand. Now, this is the reason that sometimes one restricts to a slightly a narrower class of geometries, which are called simplicial triangulations. So I just want to mention this because it's used in many simulations. So let me tell you what a simplicial triangulation is. So for any triangulation, I know I can determine what the vertices are. They're the orbits, and there are 2 of these permutations. And I can label them by numbers if I like. And then I can ask for every simplex in my triangulation what vertices it contains. Now, in a simplicial triangulation, I require that all the vertices in a tetrahedron have different labels. And also, all the vertices in a triangle have different labels. And not only that, I also require that if I give a set of labels, so here 2, 4, then there exists at most one edge that has these 2 labels at its endpoint. So in a sense, this edge is characterized by the labels on the endpoint, right? So this is not allowed in a simplicial triangulation, because these were both be called 2, 4, and there is no way to distinguish them on the basis of their vertex labels. So if I give you a set of 3 of these labels, only one triangle is allowed to exist with those labels. And I can give you a quadruple of labels, and it should determine a tetrahedron. Now, the nice thing about such simplicial triangulations is that all the information is encoded in the set of quadruples of integers that determine the tetrahedron. So why is this? Well, I claim that if I have this set, then I can uniquely reproduce a triple of these permutations up to a relabeling of all the labels on my mouse positions. Because, for instance, here I've got my tetrahedron with these 4 labels, 2, 4, 5, 6. And I can specify my mouse position as saying, OK, my mouse sits along the 2, 4 edge, on the 2, 4, 5 triangle, inside the 2, 4, 5, 6 tetrahedron. And then I can ask, well, what would happen when I do, for instance, a 2 move? Well, then the only thing, I mean, if it's sitting here on this set, then the a 2 move brings it to the 2, 4, 6 triangle. Similarly, I know that if I do the a 3 move, it has to move to a neighboring tetrahedron. But I know that it can be, in my triangulation, at most one tetrahedron which shares exactly 3 numbers with the original one. So it has to move to this tetrahedron. Okay. Yeah?
Are the simplicial triangulations automatically manifold like?
No. Well, okay. I'm defining here simplicial triangulation to be the manifold-like triangulations with this property. But no, I mean, we still need to require that when I have a simplex with these 4 numbers, that for each 3 subset of 3, say 2, 4, 5, there is another simplex that has 2, 4, 1 other simplex that also has 2, 4, 5, being this one. Okay. And then again, for the topology, one also has to work out the conditions. So here you see, I mean, if you're in this case, you only really have to keep track of d numbers per simplex. So that's why this is sometimes useful. But depending on what you want to do, if you want to do Monte Carlo simulations, this may or may not have some effect on finite size effects, discretization. And in practice, both kinds of representations are used in Monte Carlo simulations. I think it's a good time for a break. So we'll see each other in 15 minutes. So that is 54, 6 to 10.